Good morning. Now, we're going to have a problem that's my problem more than yours, and that is that when it comes to things like I've been teaching the last number of years, then I can assume that the level of knowledge of people is more or less the same. When it comes to things like halakha, then I have no idea what the level of knowledge is. On top of that, I think the second part of what's really the problem is that maybe a very, very big difference in terms of background, in terms of knowledge. So you're going to have to help me and tell me when you have no idea what I'm talking about, or tell me you just don't know how things fit in or why things fit in. And I had various thoughts about doing an introduction today. The problem is that introductions are boring and are meaningless unless you know what you're talking about, and introductions are probably better at the end of the year rather than at the beginning of the year. So it's only going to be a fake introduction, and we're not going to get through all the sources, or at least I don't believe, or I can't believe, that we're going to get through all the sources that you have in front of you. But what we're going to study today are things about studying halakha. And then from here, we'll get into various contemporary issues. But I'm going to start with an incredibly contemporary issue. And that is that today, halakha is basically out of control, and I'll explain to you exactly what I mean. It's out of control on many different fronts, and ultimately where things will end up years from now is, any of you can predict it as much as I can try to predict it. So here are the counter forces which exist today. On the one hand, you have lots and lots of books about Jewish law, about halakha. And the books that exist are increasingly more specific and more detailed, which means I don't know if any of our great-great-great-grandfathers or mothers could have imagined having a book on Kaddish, or a book on Asha Yotzar, or a book on many other topics like this. It just nobody imagined such a thing. In fact, I once sat in a lecture of Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik's son, and later on he wrote up a number of these things in a very famous article, but he pointed out that you can look at topics of books that have been published in various centuries and have a very good idea about what kinds of issues people were obsessed about. And you don't have books about how to make brachot in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. You know why? Because everyone knew how to make a bracha. They learned from their father or mother. And that was it. And things. Now, you could tell me that food technology wasn't developed and things weren't as complicated. They weren't. But on the other hand, they're not as complicated as people make them today. And that's the first part. The first part of it is when you have specified books. Now, why do you need books that are so specified? What's the answer? Why do you need books like this? The answer is you don't. But you have a lot of people who are sitting and learning that it's better for them to write a book than to just sit and learn. Now, I don't mean to be cynical, even though it may sound cynical. I'm not being cynical about this. You have another factor, and I guess this really is an introduction, but you have another factor, and that is that in this generation, there seems to be an attitude against creativity. Against creativity. Which means in the quote-unquote black hat, and certainly in the Hasidic communities, there is this attitude that you can't say anything new, you can't say anything creative. That was ultimately why I had to write my first book, because I would say things, people say, where'd you get it from? So if you say you made it up, then that's no good. If you say that it's in a book, then it's okay. Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he was asked, where'd you get that from? He said, a clear, logical mind. But there is a lack of creativity. And by the way, maybe this is worth noting, that we have lack of creativity is almost always the result, follows catastrophe. Which means after catastrophe, there's a feeling that we just lost something dramatically, and we need to gather together what was lost. So if you want to now figure out why certain books were so seminal and had such impact, like the Mishnah and like the Gemara, and like the Shulchan Aruch, all of them followed catastrophes. Be it the fall of the Beit HaMikdash and finally Hadrianic persecutions. The Talmud Yerushalmi, scholars debate back and forth why it was published, because it was published very rushed. You can see from it, it's an unfinished work. So the best theory is that there was a major earthquake that destroyed the north of Israel, and they simply collected whatever they had and went to press. The Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo, who we'll come back to more hopefully today, that follows the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and Portugal. And of Yosef Karo was born in Portugal.
What was the one that was after the earthquake?
The Jerusalem Talmud, which is a misnomer. It's really, it wasn't in Jerusalem. So the better name is the Palestinian Talmud. But since the last 20 years or so, I mean, Palestinians was not a bad word in 1948. If it said Palestinian in your passport, it meant that you were Jewish, because the Arabs said we're not Palestinians until after around 67 or 68, when they decided that being a Palestinian is a good thing to be. I mean, the funny thing, they can't even say Palestinian. They can't pronounce P's. Right. So anyway, the Holocaust is obviously another catastrophe. So how do scholars today look back at the Holocaust? So there very much would be a distinction in minds of yeshiva students. I'm not talking about reality. What do I know about reality? But in minds of yeshiva students, there would be a major difference between people that were born and educated in Europe versus yeshiva students who are educated post-Europe. Now, again, I don't know about reality. So therefore, people who come from a post-Europe generation, and obviously we're talking about the great yeshivas in Russia and Poland and Hungary and so on, the feeling seems to be collect material, collect what's there, and publish collections much more than publish new ideas. Creativity comes from comfort. It comes when you feel good about yourself. It comes when you are able to sit and to produce rather than just feel this need to collect. Anyway, in terms of intellectual history, you all have homework to do. You can go now and try to prove or to disprove what I'm saying. But nonetheless, we do find this attitude throughout Jewish history in terms of... And by the way, you could tell me that it's not a pervasive attitude, but nonetheless, it's the major books that get accepted. And it makes no difference when it comes down to it.
Is it not true, though, that people who study art history claim that the real creativity comes during times of crisis?
Could be.
But you're saying in Yadut it's different?
What I'm saying is what the people need to accept. But by the way, there's a counterbalance to all of this, which I'm not mentioning now, and that are messianic movements that also come out of it. That each time you have the major catastrophes, on its heels you find generally a false messianic movement or an aborted messianic movement. That may be that other part of it filling in, but I'm saying that there's it's more complex than this. But in terms of the books that actually get written and get comp, those are the ones. But if you look around books being published today, you don't find the same kind of creativity that you find at different points of time. That's a first. I think it's the first time anybody asked me anything about art history. I should make a shachianu.
Not only art.
Okay. Okay. So we have people feeling they need to collect all kinds of information. By the way, there's another problem that now goes together with it, and that is the amount of information that we have is obscene. Years ago, I saw a statistic that the amount of information in the world doubles every 4 years. The amount of information that exists in today with the internet, which I'm going to come back to, is I can't even imagine how much information is there. Now, you also realize something else. The vast majority of information is irrelevant, which makes it sometimes even more difficult for the scholar now to wade through between what's really silly, which is really important. But if you have a mindset of collecting, then you can drown in that. Now, what I mean by that is, I remember at one point, and I'm not sure, I didn't plan on mentioning him, but it's the third time I'm mentioning Rabbi Soloveitchik. I remember one time in class when he told us which books he had in his house growing up. Okay? So I can assure you that most of you have more books in your house right now, Jewish books, Torah books. He didn't have a whole shas. He didn't have all kinds of Rishonim and Achronim that we have. But he went through the list. He told us what he had growing up in his house. And he then said to us at the very end of giving us the list, and he says, that's why I became a Talmud Chacham. He said, why? Because I didn't read all these other things. What I had, I learned. Which means the Gemara that I had, I knew the Gemara. I knew everything on the page. I knew everything in the beginning, middle, and end. And I knew the Rambam, and that's all that I had. So that's what I worked with. And today, when you work on a topic, you have hundreds, literally hundreds of books that you need to go through because they talk about the topic. Now, what happens if there's a reason that most of these books were forgotten in the Middle Ages? Before somebody came and found an old manuscript and published the manuscript. Now, some of those, fine. Again, I'm not being cynical now. But there's a reason why certain books were published and certain books were accepted and certain books weren't accepted. But then again, how can I now then turn to a whole list of books that were found and published and say, well, those books aren't important and that's the reason they were lost? I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that there's a lot more material. So therefore, when you want to publish the conclusive, absolute book on Kaddish, you have a lot of things that you can quote. The question is how many of them are important, how many of them are relevant. Now, having said that, there's another problem. And this is worse if you only read English. Books which write about halacha, and I'm going to deal either this week or next week, I'm going to deal with halacha books. But I'm just going to start off with a little thing about them. Books about halacha cannot help themselves but to be machmir. To be strict. The reason for this is, well, what would somebody say? So the more accessible something is, the more then you have to be strict. I can show you books on every single topic that go against basic Jewish law. In which direction? Strict. I could show you books on Nida, which go against what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, and they don't even quote the Shulchan Aruch in a footnote. You would think that the Shulchan Aruch should be an important enough authority to put in a footnote, maybe, but no, because there's a stricter approach which people took afterwards. But who says that the stricter approach should be the only approach? And who says that's it? But once you're writing something in English, you're scared about your kids getting married one day. So therefore, you have to be very careful what you write. Books in Hebrew are generally not as bad, because then you can put as much whatever you want in a footnote on the bottom and make it sound academic enough, and therefore protect yourself. But the books in English very often are terrible for that reason. Now, that's one of the reasons that things are very bad. Now, what's the other reason? And this will ultimately win. What's the other reason? Is that we are in the midst of an information explosion. And that is, to a very large extent, the internet. And rabbis can write whatever they want in their books and their pamphlets and so on and take as strict of an opinion as they want. There are enough people who do know how to learn, who apparently have computers, who apparently are willing to write things on computers. The problem is that most people writing things on computers, on blogs and things like this, are writing things anonymously. So when you write something anonymously, it also doesn't have that much power to it. So then you find people who are going to be quoting out of context often, or take things from extreme situations and saying, well, what is this book writing and saying this is not allowed? Well, certainly this and this and this and this are allowed. And then you have the opposite thing taking place. So right now we live in a generation, that's what I'm saying, halacha is in trouble. It's in trouble on the one hand of all the books that are being written with taking a strict attitude, and then it's in trouble because of all the lenient attitude which you're taking, which is spread all over the place. And we're stuck someplace in the middle. And don't kid yourselves. Today, there are people who will look up a halacha not by opening the Shulchan Aruch and not even by pulling a book off of their shelf, by going on Google and looking up a law. So Rabbi Google is going to become the Gadol Hador. But what are you going to find? So if you find something written anonymously by somebody, but you like it, so then what are you going to do? You're going to take the book which says in English, you're going to take, this is authoritative. And the one thing which I think certain rabbis don't understand, or don't even want to consider, think about, contemplate, and consider the ramifications, is that you cannot suppress information. That's the one thing that the 20th century has taught us. That you cannot, what? You can try as much as you want. You're not going to succeed with suppressing information, which means if people were really sophisticated, they would be putting up their own internet sites, they would be putting up their own information over there, and they would be trying to stake the real halachic claim of the internet, because that ultimately is where people will be looking to find halacha. So, did anything I just now said make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And when you suppress information, you can get yourself in trouble. Ask Richard Nixon. You have to go to China. So is it good to... Yes?
It's something you didn't mention, but that I remember from Rabbi Soloveitchik's son's article. It's this whole idea that, in the past, people learned halacha from mimetic tradition. Yeah.
He made up that word, right? I'm kidding.
I love
but,
that.
But everyone who used it, they read that article, if anybody used that word.
But,
okay.
But, the idea that everybody, you just learned it from your parents, and they learned it from their parents.
Right.
And then there's this sort of break, which, maybe has to do with Holocaust, and maybe has to do with immigration to America, where people are opened up to new ideas and there's assimilation. And so then, when you get people who are coming back, they don't know what to do.
Right.
So then you need books.
But it's not just that. Let's not blame the Balchuvas for everything. They're only partially responsible. It's not the Balchuvas. Really, what he points out in the article is the shifting of halachic responsibility from the rabbis of communities who were trained to Rosh Yeshivas who aren't. And a community rabbi deals with reality while a Rosh Yeshiva deals with theory.
And also, if a community rabbi faces the Akunah every Shabbat or whatever, where they don't even...
Right. I'm saying the difference between a theoretician versus being a practitioner is an incredible distinction. And when you have the yeshivas winning out over the community rabbis, then you end up having a shift in practice. So that's at least, I would say, even more of the factors than the Balchuvas entering into community. Because when Balchuvas enter the community, correct, they don't know, but what are they doing? They're turning to people and looking what people do. And they may be even guilty, even more than anyone else, of mimicking what other people do, but who are they mimicking? So they're generally entering in through yeshivas, although, I've seen studies on that. It's not all the time, but generally what they're being impacted on is by yeshivas. Anybody want to read that article? It's called Rupture and Reconstruction, and if you Google those words, Rupture and Reconstruction, and Chaim Soloveitchik, which he spells in a bizarre way, H-I-Y-M with a dot under the Y, and the Lookstein Center in Bar-Ilan has it online. You can find the article. Print it out and take a couple days to read it. Reconstruction. It was originally published in Tradition, if not mistaken, but he'd given the lecture a number of times. Excuse me?
That wasn't that written as Azure?
No, there was a follow-up, but I think the first one was in Tradition. I think. Maybe I'm wrong. So is it good to study halacha or is it bad to study halacha? I know this sounds like a bizarre question. So it's probably good to study halacha properly, which now I'm setting myself up, because, who said that I can do this properly? I don't like when people get up in shul or other places and give a Dvar Torah on halacha. I don't mind if they get up and say something on the Chumash. I don't mind if they say something in Machshava. I don't mind if they give a nice idea, quote something in Pirkei Avos. All that's very nice. But when you say something very brief in halacha, the odds are that you're being superficial and maybe misstating something. It's a problem. I was in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't know exactly what time they were davening in the place that I was going to go, which I didn't know where I was going to go, but I come in for the end of the first minyan and the beginning of before the beginning of the second minyan. So I put on my talit and tefillin, and I sit down and I learn until the second minyan begins, and the rabbi gets up at the end of the first minyan and says a dvar halacha, which was very, very nice. He got up, and it seemed to be an ongoing topic that he had been talking about, so that there was background before, it wasn't just brief, and he got up and he spoke about the problem of quoting during liturgy half a pasuk. Or, for example, in Kiddush, Vayir, Vayivokir, do you say, or Yom HaShishi, how do you do this? There's a problem, which we're not going to get into. And he mentioned the problem, he mentioned some solutions and so on, which was very nice. Stayed for the second minyan, the assistant rabbi got up after the second minyan, and this was before Rosh Hashanah, and he gets up, and again, he has like 2.5 minutes, and he says, many people have a custom of eating an apple or something on Rosh Hashanah night and dipping it in honey. He goes, this is a terrible problem. Because what about a bracha? Do you make a bracha? Do you not make a bracha? Make a bracha on the apple. You already washed. You already didn't wash. And now you make a bracha Rishon. You make a bracha Achrona. And on top of all that, what kind of prayer is this? You're praying for good luck. The whole thing is like idolatry, and the whole thing is very problematic. And he sits down. this was his... And we'll have to talk more about it, okay? So this was his Dvar Torah. So I walked over to him. I couldn't help myself. I'm sorry. And I know I have to do Yom Kippur already passed. I already did tshuva and whatever. No, the only reason I have to do tshuva is because I enjoyed it too much. But I walked over to him and I said, you can solve your first problem in terms of your whole bracha controversy by eating the apple before the motzi and after Kiddush. And he just looks at me and like his eyes are real wide. And he goes, yeah, I guess. And I said, as far as the second problem goes in terms of this being like idolatry, I would point out, I know the Siman HaShulchan Aruch, this is very interesting in terms of, you get to a light and you say, well, if this turns green, I'm going to go straight. If it turns red, I'm going to go right. Are you allowed to do that? It's called Darkei Amori. Is that allowed? Not allowed? That is allowed, but why is it allowed? It's not so simple. To use signs. Black cat passes in front of you, you're going to have bad luck all day. That's called Darkei Amori. Torah law you're breaking. So I said to him that when you're praying, you're not praying to the apple. And on top of all this, it's a Gemara. The Gemara says that simana milta, that when you do something, it causes an impact. So to pray for a sweet year is considered a prayer. There's no Darkei Amori. This is the Gemara. This is the Shulchan Aruch. And he goes, yeah, this is just part of a larger share that I've given. I said, I understand. But you've just now told a whole group of people that it's very problematic to do what Jews do. He was very young. So he said, who are you? So I said, I'm friends with your rabbi. Ask him, he knows who I am. I didn't tell him who I was. Didn't want him burning my books. The opposite is really true. Once they burn your books, then they sell. So is it good to learn halacha? Is it bad to learn halacha? And on top of all that, what is halacha? And that's something that we really need to get to. Because I do plan this year of getting to controversial issues, important issues, a lot of issues in terms of medical ethics, life and death issues, be it abortion, be it euthanasia, and other things. I plan on getting there, but we can't jump into those right away because we'll see sources, and what do the sources mean? So we just need a little bit before we go there. So is learning halacha good? So first the answer is yes. I'll quote a Gemara in source number one, which you remember from your davening someplace. They stick it in there because they like this one. Tana de Eliyahu is taught in the house of Eliyahu, which literally means the Beit Midrash of Eliyahu. Kol hashoneh halachot, whoever learns halachot. Shoneh could come from the word shtayim, from the word, and the English translation here is repeat. Somebody who repeats in halachot. Although the word shoneh, as we'll see later on, can also mean from the word mishnah, which is teaching. Kol ha-shoneh halachot, whoever learns or teaches halachot, muvtach lo shehu ben olam haba, has a guarantee that they have a share in the world to come. Shoneh amar, as it says, halichot olam lo. Al tikri halichot, ela halachot. So what does halichot mean? From the word steps, walking. Halichot olam. So olam can be forever, the world. So over here it's a play on words. The Gemara is really not claiming this is what the verse means, which is why I didn't even bother bringing the verse. What is the Gemara telling us? It's anchoring the idea. So what's the Gemara's point over here? It's good to learn halacha. So there you go. You have your answer. Learning halacha is good. But before we get to is it really good, or we'll get to all the people that say that people that learn halacha are in a great deal of trouble, I wanted to deal first with this, a more basic question, which deals with all of Torah Shebal Peh, and that is the question of writing it down, which means I meant to touch it, it was in my head, the beginning of the printing press, which had an enormous effect. I mean, those were books published versus not, but what was the first Hebrew book published?
The Bible.
No, not in Hebrew. The first Hebrew book published in Hebrew. It's an easy answer. When I say it, you'll say, oh, that makes sense. Rashi and Chumash. Rashi and Chumash was the first book published. The most popular book which was published for the first 100 years of the printing press, I believe, okay, obviously you'll say Tanakh, the Torah, Shulchan Aruch, was one of the most popular books around. The printing press has had an enormous impact on halacha. But you know, there's a word that we all know. What's the or phrase we all know? What's that called? Torah she'ba'al peh. So what does that mean, Torah she'ba'al peh? Apparently it means that there's one part of Torah that the way to teach it is by writing it down, and the words are holy, and that's called Chumash, Tanakh. On the other hand, there's something where there must be some verbal or oral element to it, although we're not exactly sure what it is. In source number 3, and then we'll come back to 2, it says, V'tani debei Rabbi Yishmael. This is a Gemara I'm quoting in Temura. You have almost the same Gemara in Gittin. I like the way it was in Temura a little bit better, although the more famous time is in Gittin and Daf Samach. V'tana debei Rabbi Yishmael. It was taught in the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yishmael. Kitav lecha et hadavrim ha'ele. God tells Moshe, write these things. So what's the emphasis on these things? This you should write and not other things. Ele ata kotev, which means Torah shebichtav, you're to write. Aval I ata kotev halachot. You're not allowed to write down halachot. And by the way, when we talk about studying halacha, most of you, the idea of studying halacha is going to be from some book. And I've already told you why books are bad and computers bad and everything is bad. You're not allowed to write it down in the first place. So if you're not allowed to write it down, how are you supposed to learn it? From a teacher. Amri, dilma milta chadati shani. The Gemara says, maybe something is new. When there's a new interpretation, maybe that's different. Tahor Rabbi Yochanan of Reish Lakish, ma'ayne b'sifra da'agadata b'shapta. Rabbi Yochanan of Reish Lakish, they were sitting and learning together a book of agadot, a book of stories, legends. V'dorshi hachi, and this is how they justified themselves. Et lasot Hashem, heferu Torahtecha. Now that's that verse which we skipped. Eit lasot Lashem. There's a time to act for God. Heferu Torahtecha, which could be translated then as to break the halacha. Now if you look at the English translation of the verse in Tehillim, it says, Eit lasot, it's time to act, Lahashem. Heferu Torahtecha. Why? Because they have made void your Torah, which means at least this translation, you can go look it up in the commentaries, but this does sound as the pshat, that it's time to act because people have broken Torah. The Gemara understands from this that sometimes you're allowed to break the Torah to keep the Torah, which itself is a very interesting topic, and wouldn't we love to know how broadly we can possibly make applications of that principle. But over here, they continue to say in the last line of source 3, Amri, mutav te'aker Torah, it's better to break something in Torah. What are they going to break? The prohibition against writing it. Va'al tishtakach Torah miYisrael, and let Torah not be forgotten from the Jewish people. Which means they're claiming, yes, there's a Torah shebichtav, and yes, there's a Torah shebaal peh, but there is a time comes that we have to write down Torah shebaal peh. Now, let me ask you a question. When was the first time Torah Shebaal Peh was written? Is this the source or the Mishnah? Like everything else, you should suspect that that's a machloket. Okay? Sefer Devarim. Okay, Sefer Devarim. When is the first time the Torah Shebaal Peh is written down? So the answer to this question may actually be significant enough that it will end up defining what is Torah Shebaal Peh. So let's start all over again. Why would you tell me that you're not allowed to write Torah Shebaal Peh? What would be the problem with writing it down?
Shebaal Peh means that it's by heart.
I know, but what's the problem? What?
Writing incorrectly?
Then why should we be allowed to write the Torah? Okay. So it would seem correct. It would seem to be that when it comes to Torah Shebichtav, the words are important. When it comes to Torah Shebaal Peh, the ideas are important. And when words encapsulate an idea, those words can be limited to a particular time and place. And therefore, in order to keep it your word dynamic, in order to keep it alive, it would therefore necessitate to keep the particular words separate from the idea. And therefore, each teacher in each generation would look at their students and give the examples, the analogies, the words that that particular student, place, or time, generation would appreciate, and then they would in turn, hopefully, understand the core ideas and pass over the core ideas. You know, sometimes people say, I mean, especially, you know, students have the opportunity to be cynical, they'll say, you know, shouldn't Torah Shabbat Peh be like a game of telephone? A game of broken telephone, where if you whisper something over here, by the time you get to the end of the room, the message has changed completely. And at first glance, that's a wonderful question, but in reality, there's no comparison. Because when it comes to, quote-unquote, the game of telephone, first of all, I'm not going to do this here, but I've asked many people over the years, and at least half the room, between 30 to 50%, will admit that they deliberately changed the message. Because what fun is it if it comes... Those of you who are shocked right now, I'm sorry that you just lost your innocence in my class. It's... For those of you who are not laughing...
Someone doesn't hear so well the message today.
What did you say? No, I'm kidding. I shouldn't make fun of you. No. You hear what you want to hear still. She heard that. Her mother lost her hearing. And what did she hear?
What we didn't want her to hear.
Exactly. Nothing else.
Low voice, we always heard it.
Right. So apparently she just heard different levels. She couldn't hear the higher level. Anyway, the game of telephone, you whisper something, many people that are trying to change it, the odds of it coming out at the end are nil because people are trying to change it. Aside from the fact that conditions are such that you're whispering it, Torah Shebaal Peh, you're explaining it clearly, using examples that the person you're speaking to should best understand, and there is this whole element that you mentioned earlier, and what's that? The whole idea of mimicking the person who's doing it, which means... If I tell my 13-year-old son a week before his bar mitzvah, you know what, for generations, Jews put on tefillin, and you have to put it on every day on your head and your leg. Is he going to put it on his leg? No. What's it, why would the fact that I changed the word and made a mistake not impact the halakha? Because he's seen thousands of people over the years put it on the arm. Which means the word over here is not the essential part. Having seen people practice Jewish law, how many of your... daughters, or for that matter, mothers, light Shabbos candles the same way that you do. I can't do it. Men can't move their hands like that. Ema, you want to show them how to do it? Okay. Right? So how many of you do it the same way that, right? This is something which is passed on. So the fact that somebody may whisper something has nothing to do with the way the Torah Shebaal Peh has been passed on from generation to generation. But there's another element, and that is, and we'll see that this is really the crux of a machloket between Rishonim. But to get to this, was Yehoshua, when no one was looking, when he finished hearing Moshe Shir, was he allowed to take his own notes and keep them in his pocket? Which means, was there an absolute prohibition against writing Torah Shebaal Peh, or is there prohibition against teaching by the written word? Do you appreciate the difference between the two? See, teaching by the written word, which is something that we're very used to, I mean, I hope most of you have read books in your lives, and lots of books, but the way that you accrue knowledge through the written word versus the way that you accrue knowledge from direct study with a master would be very, very different. Which means it's completely possible, and one of my professors in graduate school, Professor Hovland, published an article about this. It could very well be that the difference between the Rishonim versus the Achronim, Right. In your heads, what's the difference between? Why do they decide one day these are the Rishonim and somebody decide the next day, okay, you're no longer a Rishon, that's it, you're an Achron. These words, by the way, what do they mean? Early authorities and later authorities. Where's the line? The Shulchan Aruch is right around the line. Although you'll hear people claim that Rav Yosef Karo was a Rishon, while the Ramah of Moshe Isserlish was an Achron. By the way, they lived at the same time. why is one a Rishon, one an Achron? Very difficult to make that argument. But it's possible that the line between the two of them is the printing press. The difference between having to have studied from a teacher versus having books mass-produced and being able to read something. Because mass production of information, again, you can't suppress information, but the fact that there's more information out there, does that now mean that the student understands it with the same depth that they would have understood it if they studied it directly from a teacher? Which means right there, it seems to be that it was felt that there was a drop-off in terms of scholarship. Could there be other factors? Certainly could be. But again, it's very interesting to think about the printing press as what, let's phrase it this way, what impact did the printing press have on the development of halacha? So right away you realize a lot more books out there. So what does that mean? A lot more knowledge out there. What does that mean? Well, it means that one hand it's great because there's more knowledge. On the other hand, it means more superficiality because there'll be more people who don't necessarily understand as well as they would have understood if they had a direct tutorial with their mentor. So there's going to be a drop-off there. And by the way, the same thing is now going to be true in terms of the internet. That's what I was saying before. There's just so much more information out there, but so much of it is trivial. By the way, that's really what the internet has given us. It's given us trivial information. A lot of it's very interesting, but it's trivial. Is there also deep things there? Yes, but what it spread, bad jokes on email, right? And trivial information seems to come at us, and that's what spread instead of real depth of knowledge and understanding. Look, let me put it a little differently. Teaching in university for the last, I don't know how many years. I don't know what year is this. Okay, 18 years. Students today no longer know how to go to a library. Tell them to do research again. They go to Google. You found an article that spoke about it, so then you copy, cut, and paste, and you have your article. And if they really want to work hard, then they'll change a couple of the words within it. And they don't even know that this is something. Forget that it's not ethical. Forget all the rest of it. They don't know how to go and actually do research, and that's something which is an art, which is being forgotten. Any of you who have school-age kids, don't expect any teacher to teach your kid how to learn or how to do research. They don't do that. Yeah. Write a paper. I mean, Israeli schools anyway, they grade the parents, they don't grade the children. That's
long before the internet.
That they grade the parents.
No, the teacher didn't teach the kids how to do
research. Maybe somewhere along the line, someone. Let's look at Rashi in source 4. Eight lasot Lashem. Rashi interprets this with a slight difference. You can decide if it's significant or not. In his commentary to Temura, which is a Gemara, versus Gittin. In 4 he says, eight lasot Lashem. Kisha osin adavar l'shem k'dushat Hashem. When you're doing something for where your attitude is to sanctify God's name, ro'ui lahafir toratecha, it's worthwhile to break the Torah, umutav taker, it's better, you know, to be taken out. Which means he's saying, if the objective is, source 4, if the objective is learning, and this is the way the learning will be more effective, so therefore it is the breaking of Torah which becomes the upkeep of Torah. So therefore, even though there was a prohibition against writing the oral Torah, here we're saying to write it, otherwise it will be forgotten. Although, now we have to add in our Rashi to Rashi, but will there be a price paid for writing it down? Okay, that becomes the issue. Rashi in the second part of source 4, Eight Lasot Lashem, Ve'im Ba Eight Lasot Takana Lashem Shamayim, Hiferu divrei Torah l'sha hatzricha. If there comes something that you can fix something l'shem shemayim for the sake of heaven, then you can break the Torah l'sha hatzricha. What does that mean, l'sha hatzricha? When necessary. But by the way, what's the difference between those two formulations in Rashi and Gittin verses in Temura? The second one is much more conditional, which means, are you allowed to take notes of this class? Yeah. Are you allowed to just make as many photocopies just because you don't know why? No. According to the second Rashi, you're only allowed to write Torah Shebal Peh as necessary. By the way, a whole other part comes to it. What holiness does Torah Shebal have when it's written? Or let me put it this way. Let's say you took notes of a class, and let's say you had a final in it. You took the final, you'll never look at these notes again, you don't need them anymore. Do they, now, the justification for writing them doesn't exist anymore. Right? Do they still have holiness, or is only temporary holiness, or do they ever have holiness? Which means, do you treat words which are written with the same holiness or not? Which means, you're not allowed to write Torah Shebal Peh. Right? Now we have permission to write it. Once we write it, does it have holiness or not? By the way, think in the shuls, I don't know if you ever thought about this, how many boxes and boxes they have of what we used to call Shemus, mm-hmm. right? Of all, what? They call it other things in Hebrew. Geniza. But you think, by the way, in all the shuls where they give it all these things, all these alonim, which if I were in charge, I would make them prohibited to give them out. Right? Do you ever see a men's section on a Friday night? The singing Lecha Dodi, reading, everybody's reading something or other, which means that they should definitely make them not allowed to give out. Have them out, have them put outside the shul when people finish davening, they can take home. But what happens when you have mountains of these every Shabbat, and then forget about the kids' work and whatever, all of this stuff, does it now have the same status? Now you're going to tell me, obviously, no. So does it have the same status as a Sefer Torah that's no longer kosher for whatever reason? What do you do with the Sefer Torah? You bury it. Does all this stuff need to be buried? Which means Torah Shebal Peh, which was written, where you no longer need it, does it still? Did it ever have holiness? Does it retain the holiness? I won't answer that yet, unless you make me.
Are you going to
eventually? Maybe.
Okay,
if it has no value anymore to you, so then it could be that it lost whatever, that it's based on utility. And there would be a problem. Now, you can think laws of Shemitah in the back of your head right now. There would be a problem of taking it into and putting it into a garbage pail together with garbage, but because then you're defacing it. But if you put it in a plastic bag and tied it up and then put it in the garbage, that would be fine. Or for that matter, you put it in a recycle, that would also be fine. Because it's not, because it no longer has its holiness to it, because that was based upon functionality. What's the matter? you were saving the ecology. Eight lasot Hashem. That's also a significant factor. But therefore, once it no longer has purpose, then it shouldn't be defaced. But as I said, it could be tied up and put in a bag and so on. Yeah.
But the issue with Shemus is not necessarily that. It, let's say it was something with Tosh.
Why is it called Shemus? Why is it called Shemus? Because it had Shem Hashem. No, one second. Because then there's a Torah prohibition against erasing the name of God, which is a Sefer Torah has holiness no matter what, it needs to be buried. Anything else that has the name of God written on it, it's the name of God. That's why they called it Shemus. It's the shame of name of God on it. So therefore, if you have a whole big page, the name of God is on it, so then you take a scissor and you cut out the name of God, you collect all your names of God, and you can that you can keep separate. But it doesn't mean that the whole page has holiness. Right, right, correct.
So these papers here that have all
these are holy. These are holy. I always try. I sometimes miss it, but I always try to take out the name of Hashem and just have a hey on it. And if that's considered holy, so then you're in trouble, because then anybody who writes, you know, bet hey on top of their page, so they're done. And for that matter, you can't go into the bathroom with a coin in your pocket or. At least American dollars, God we trust. Cause that, okay, if you want to, I'll talk about that, but not now. Okay. So the difference between those two Rashis was the second one is telling us this is a temporary permission as necessary. And we have to, meaning we live in a world, we don't think twice about photocopying something. We don't think twice about writing something down, because we just assume that once Torah Shebal Peh is written, it's written. No condition. Rashi's approach and there were other Rashis which I may have deleted, but Rashi's approach is that Torah Shebal Peh was not allowed to be written down, period. That was it. It was not allowed. You're not allowed to write it. Now, with this thing, Eight lasot l'Hashem, you're allowed to write it down. Temporarily, as long as necessary. The Rambam apparently has a very different approach. The Rambam is in source number 5. The HaMitzvah, this is in his introduction to the Rambam. By the way, for those of you who don't know, the Rambam, I'll give you his exact dates. Even give you his English date. It was March 30th, 1135, according to Wikipedia. And he died December 13th, 2004, which means the previous year was a leap year because he died. It was Kaf Tevet, and that's very early for Kaf Tevet. The Rambam, 12,004. The Rambam was born in 1204. He was born in Spain, and he died in Egypt, and as you know, he spent most of his life in Egypt. What's interesting, again, I'll give you his dates. It's 1135 to 1204. Rashi is 1040 to 1105. Now, despite the fact that the Rambam was born 25 years after Rashi died, apparently the Rambam never saw Rashi's writings. Never in any place does he quote him, make reference to him, even though the Rambam has letters going back and forth with the Balei HaTosfot, with Rashi's children, grandchildren, students, and students of students, the Rambam had no direct contact with Rashi, and I'm saying, obviously in life, because he was born afterwards, but he never saw, as far as we know, any of Rashi's writings, which again, is just something interesting, but that also tells you a little bit about the difference of living in a time before printing press, email, faxes, SMS, Rashi and the Rambam, even though you're telling me, but there would have been enough time. No. Being born 25 years after Rashi died, living the other end of the world, was not enough time for the Rambam to ever see Rashi's writings. Okay, that just something for you to think about, how different, because today, somebody can write something and put it someplace, and instant information all over the world. That is also a major difference in terms of well, let me put it this way. It can very well impact issues in halacha as well, and I think that therefore sometimes rabbis are afraid of publishing what they say or saying to a wider audience because the second they say something today, it'll be all over the place, which means 100 years ago, a rabbi could say something in his local town and not even be worried it's going to get over to the next town. Today, people have to be very careful, and it's just a factor. I'm not saying this is good or bad necessarily. The introduction over here is a wonderful, wonderful work. When you have time, you'll read the whole thing. I gave you a lot of English over here. At the very end, I gave you a website, the end of source 5, www.mechonmamre.org, where they have an English copy of the introduction of the Rambam up on their website. That's where I took it from. I did not translate this for you myself. Although Machon Mamre has some idiosyncrasies, one of them is they apparently prefer the Yemenite version of the Rambam's writings. The Rambam's writings spread through North Africa, Africa, and then the rest of the world, and the Yemenites have always felt that they have the best, most authoritative tradition of what the Rambam actually said, which was sometimes true and sometimes not true. One of the most famous Yemenite rabbis of last century, was Rabbi Kapach, and he published the Rambam's writings on various things, including the Mishnah, which he did a wonderful work of retranslating it from the Arabic, and afterwards he published the Mishnah Torah itself. But when he published the Mishnah Torah, he used Yemenite manuscripts, but sometimes we have the Rambam's actual signature on your manuscript saying that he went through, somebody copied it, but he went through it and he signed, this is an authoritative manuscript. So he preferred the Yemenite tradition above the Rambam's autograph. So most scholars, excuse me? They're minor differences. But again, most scholars will tell you that that was a mistake. But as I said, the Yemenites seem to love their tradition. The Yemenites have kept all kinds of traditions other people don't have. So let's read the Hebrew, and you can read the English, which is a translation of the Yemenite manuscript. Source 5. V'hamitzvah, shehi pirusha Torah, lo katva ela tziva ba lezekinim liyoshua l'shar kol Yisrael. So the Rambam makes a distinction between what he calls Torah versus mitzvah. And he says the Torah is the Torah shebichtav, and this is based upon a verse in Shmot, Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Yud Bet. Moshe goes up to get the Torah v'mitzvah, and so on and so forth. God says, I lay alay ahara v'yesham v'tein lecha et lucha to evin v'torah mitzvah shekatavti l'toratam, and so on. So the Rambam understands that Torah is Torah shebichtav, and mitzvah is Torah shebal peh. So what does he say over here in 5? Hamitzvah shepirisha haTorah, it's the explanation of Torah, lo katva. What does lo katva mean? Right, all of us think we know what this means. Lo katva means it was not written down. Rather, tzivaba, Moshe commanded it to the Zakenim, to Yeshua, ul'shar kol Yisrael, and to the rest of the Jewish people. Okay, that was easy. You notice the dot, dot, dot there? Mm-hmm. Good, we're skipping. What the Rambam does in this introduction is he gives you the state of affairs of the oral Torah from Moshe all the way to his father and himself. So his authority for writing the book that he writes, he can trace his tradition right back to Moshe. That's the purpose over here. We skipped and we got to Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Who's Rabbeinu HaKadosh? Rabbeinu HaKadosh is Rav Yehuda HaNasi, and he's the one who you told me before. What's your name? Naomi told me before, he's the one who wrote the Mishnah. What? Right, you almost said that. And that would be right according to Rashi, that it was, the Mishnah was not written, the Oral Torah was not written until the time of Rebbe. Rabbeinu HaKadosh chibur HaMishnah, umiyamot Moshe Rabbeinu va'ad Rabbeinu HaKadosh, lo chibru chibur shemelamdim ota berabim b'Torah shebal peh. He says that from the time of Moshe until Rav Yehuda HaNasi, there was no official book which was used in order to teach Torah Shebal Peh. Ela b'chol dor v'dor, Rosh Beitin, o Navi, Shahaya ba'oto ador, in every generation, the head of the court or the prophet that lived in that generation, kotev la'atzmo zichron hashmuot sheshama mirabotav, he would write down his own personal notes that he heard from his teachers, for whom made al peh birabim, but the teaching had to be done orally or verbally. But do you notice this is a very different approach than Rashi told us? By the way, there's a very famous book which is called the Igeret of Rav Shwira Gaon, the letter of Rav Shwira Gaon. He was asked by a community in North Africa, what is this stuff called Torah? What is Torah Shebal Peh? What is the Gemara? Where does it come from? The community wanted to know, give us an authoritative answer, how we make sense out of all of these things. And Rav Shwira Gaon sat down and wrote a letter, which is a book. But the letter exists today in two different versions. And the biggest difference between the two different versions is the one that says Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi published the Mishnah or whether he wrote the Mishnah. Which means, is this the first time, basically, this argument between Rashi and the Rambam is an older argument that we find, and we can't really sense what was the earlier version, what was official. But each, as the letter got to different places, I think people made slight adjustments to fit into the tradition that they understood. And by the way, see, that's a problem, because when you copy something, it's not always that there's a conscious ideological change which is taking place, that you copy something according to your understanding of what you're reading. And therefore, when it came to the letter of Shwira Gaon, there were two different versions, but it reflects exactly what we just now saw, the difference between the Rambam and Rashi. So according to Rashi, the prohibition was writing down words of Torah Shebal Peh. According to Rashi, that would apply till today. If it's not necessary to write it down, you can't write it down. If it's necessary for Torah to be saved, you break Torah to save Torah. Which means when it comes to teaching Torah, I have to, instead of having a myopic look and saying, in a very narrow sense, I can't write it, I have to have a much broader sense and say, what's the best way for this Torah to stay alive and go from generation to generation? In the introduction that I wrote to my first book, one of the things that I dealt with is, are you allowed to write a book and why can you write a book? And there's a prohibition against Torah being forgotten. So there's somebody known as The first Lubavitcher Rebbe, who's known as the Baal HaTanya, or the Rav, he was known as. He wrote the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. You know what his name? His name was Shneur Zalman from Liadi. And because his name was Shneur, what did his children call themselves? Shneur's son, right? So that's where the name comes from. So Rav Shneur Zalman, he writes in his Laws of Studying Torah that you can't go on to law number two unless you remember law number one. So he basically says you have to study the same thing again and again and again and again and again and again and again until you remember it. Then you can go on to the next thing because you're not allowed to forget Torah. Rav Chaim Volozhin, who lives at the same time, a student of the Vilna Gaon, he says no. He says that the prohibition is against Torah being forgotten from the Jewish people. So therefore, if there's something which the Jewish people knows, so then there's not a prohibition that you personally don't remember it. But on the other hand, if there's something that nobody else knows, then you have that. Then you're not allowed to forget it. So therefore, if you, any of you, and take yourself seriously, if any of you ever come up with an insight in terms of Torah, and every one of you can, you're sitting in shul on Shabbat and you hear the Torah being read, or you look inside and you have an insight, you know what? Have a notebook at home, which is your personal notebook, where you write down your insights. They actually sell these books in bookstores in Mayasharim. They say on the front page, Chidushe Torah. And then you open up and they're empty. Right? It's a very nice book. Every single person should have their own notebook. I'm not saying that everything, but things that you have your own thought, it should be written down. It could be later on you find out that someone else had that thought beforehand, but it could be that no one ever had that thought. And if it's a thought about Torah that no one ever had, there could be a prohibition of forgetting it, and that was my justification for writing the book. But over here, the Rambam is telling us that there were private notes existing. Now, what would that mean for us? That would mean that every single one of you don't have to feel guilty about taking notes. You're allowed to take notes. You're allowed to take notes to remember things, and that's not a problem. What's the problem?
Publishing.
Now, there's a difference between publishing versus writing. By the way, there is a much broader issue over here, which Professor Lieberman, Saul Lieberman, in various articles and books dealt with in terms of publication in antiquity. The Iliad and the Odyssey, Homer, were these things published? What were they? Were they published first or written first?
No.
They were published first. I know that it sounded a little funny. They were published. What does published mean? Published means made public. So what would they do? They would have a convention of Iliad teachers who would get together and they would go over it orally. And one official version of it was established, and then they would all teach the same thing. That was the publication of it, but it wasn't written yet. Which means that's the argument in the book of Rav Shmuel Gaon. Did Rabbi Yehuda Anasi write the Mishnah, or did he publish the Mishnah? Which means there are those who claim he never wrote it. The Mishnah is written afterwards. What do you mean he didn't write the Mishnah? Say, the Mishnah is the word. No, the Mishnah, what's the problem with the Mishnah? Go back to what I told you earlier. The oral Torah is what? It's about ideas or words? So what did he do when he makes the Mishnah? He turns it into words. That was the major shift that took place. He turned it into words. Does that necessarily mean that he wrote those words as well? That point is debated. So I'm just pointing out that you can have publication before you have writing. By the way, this is also true today. You can have all kinds of people putting blogs up, putting all kinds of things up where they become public. You want to call them public. So they're written, but they're not in book form or published in the same sense. I'm just saying, at the point that something changes from being from a Rishut HaYachid to Rishut HaRabim, something goes from the private domain to the public domain, at that point it becomes published. What the interrelationship there is between with writing is a bigger question. Let's continue, because we have to get to one point that I can leave you on. We're in the second line from the top of the page on page 2. El b'chol dor v'dor rosh beitin. We did that. Fourth line. V'chein kol achad v'achad kotev la'atzmo kifi kocho. Every person was allowed to write according to their own capabilities. Mibiur ha-Torah mihalachotea kamosha shema, based on what they heard, what they understand. Umidvarim shenichadshu b'chol dor v'dor bedinim shelo limdu mipi ha-shmua el b'minda mishloshet esrei. And also new laws, new applications would be written as well. And so on and so forth. I'm skipping to five lines in the bottom of that paragraph, middle of the line, beginning of the line. Malkom, it says, Kedei shelo tishkach Torah shebal peh Yisrael. Why would they allow this so that the Torah should not be forgotten? V'lama asar Rebbe HaKadosh kach, v'lo hiniach ha-davar kamot shaya. Why did he make this shift? Lefi shirosh ha-tamidim mitma'atim v'holchim v'atzarot mitchadshot u'ba'ot u'malachot rom miposhetet b'lo mitkabar. By the way, catastrophe. It's very interesting. The Rambam is giving a historical reason for this, which, again, shouldn't surprise us, is that the Romans had taken control and the Jews were going to be spread out through the world. There was a fear that things would be forgotten. Go down to the bottom of that page of 2. Uvizman hazeh takfu atzarot yeterot. Again, he's talking about catastrophe in his own generation. And here he says, now this is going to be the justification for his own book. V'dachka sha'at kol et hakol v'avda chachma chachmenu v'inat nevunenu nistara. Knowledge has been forgotten, and so on and so forth. L'fichach otom ha'perishim v'alachot v'atshuvot shechibru agonim v'ru'u shehim dvarim v'vorinim nitkashu b'yameinu v'ein mivin einehim kira'oi ele ma'at misbar. Most people don't have the capability of reading halachic works. Ve'ein tzarech lomar ha'gemara atzma ha'bavlit v'yerushalmit v'sifra v'sifri v'tosefta shem tzrichim da'at rechava v'nefesh chachma v'zman aroch. You need to be smart and have lots of time to be able to learn these things. V'achach yudei mehim ha'derech ha'nechocha b'dvarim ha'asurim v'muturim. In order to really know how to live as a Jew, he goes on to say that that's not so simple. U'mepnei zeh ni'arti chatzni ani Moshe ben Maimon ha'sfaradi. Unishanti alatsur baruchu, I woke up, I rely upon God, hu uvinoti, b'chol elu asfarim v'ra'iti, l'chaber dvarim hamidbarerim, mikol elu achiburim, b'inyan ha'asur v'hamutar, ha'tameh v'hatahor, imshar dinei ha'torah.
What is chatzin?
I think it means like an arrow. Kulam v'lashon brura v'derech k'tzara, ad she'torah sheba'al peh, Kulas dura mipi bipi hakol velo kushya velo piruk. I've decided to take all of Torah and make it simple. No questions, no answers. Like the Gemara takes you from what, right? It asks a question, it gives an answer. You lose yourself in the way. The Rambam says, "I'm cutting all of it out." Bottom line: lo ze amur becho veze becho elad dvarim brurim krovim v'nechonim al pi hamishpat hashet ba'er b'kol elo achiburim v'pirushim nimtzeim miyamot Rabbeinu HaKadosh v'ad achshav. I've availed myself to all books from the time of Rebbe till today. Ad shu kol adinim hagluyim l'katan l'gadol b'din kol mitzvah u'mitzvah u'b'din kol advim shetiknu chachamim v'nevi'im. Klalo shel davar kedei shelo ye'adam tzarech l'chibor acher ba'olam. That a person should never need another book. B'din midinei Yisrael, ella yehei chibur zeh mikabetz l'torah shebal peh, kula, im hatkanot v'haminhagot v'agzerot shenasu miyamot Moshe Rabbeinu v'ad chibur gemara, u'kamo shepirshu lanu ga'onim b'chol chibureim shechibru achar gemara. I've used everything that is there, all the things from the gemara, after the gemara, the time of the ga'onim, l'fichach karati shem chibur zeh mishna torah, which means the repetition of the Torah, l'fisha adam korei b'torah shebichtav tchila, v'achar kach korei b'zeh. Person will read this. And now, do you think that a line like this is going to go unnoticed? There's a person known as the Ravid. The Ravid, as you see here, I give you a different font, Hasagat HaRavid. The Ravid wrote what today would be called a book review of the Rambam. He got it, the Rambam's reputation was worldwide. The Ravid lived in what today would be called France. He got his hands on this book, and he read this line, and he went crazy. Omar Avraham, that's the Aleph there. Savar l'takein v'lo tikein ki ozav derech kol ha'machabrim. He wants to fix. He didn't fix anything. He has left the way, left the path of all the other authors. Ashei hayu l'fanav ki heim hivyu ra'ya l'dvrehim. Every other author would bring proof to their words. V'katfu advarim b'shem amram. And they would quote where they're getting it from. Which means the Rambam writes the first blog. He writes it, well, at least he writes his name there. But he doesn't write where he gets it from, doesn't write who said this. You ask him, where did he get it from? What would his answer be? A clear and logical mind. That's what the Rambam would say. V'hayu lo b'zeh to elit gdola ki pa'amim rabot yaleh alev hadayan la'asor la'tir. And so on. He doesn't like this, and he has one great line at some point over here. He feels the Rambam